This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Driving around in a death trap? Fossil smog is killing almost 100,000 Americans a year. From UCL and University of Birmingham, Dr. Karin Vohra on the real cost of oil and gas in the USA. Few of us could name the third biggest greenhouse gas, the ins and outs of ozone and global warming, with Professor Bill Collins from University of Reading. This is Radio EcoShock. Americans die younger than men and women in the UK or Scandinavia, like 5 to 7 fewer years of life expectancy. There are many factors, but a big one is simple: living with lots of oil and gas pollution. From well sites all the way to our tailpipes and factories, fossil fuel robs years of life. These days you can't make such claims without a lot of proof. We have that now in a new paper called The Health Burden and Racial Ethnic Disparities of Air Pollution from Major Oil and Gas Life Cycle Stages in the United States. The lead author is Dr. Karin Vohra, a research fellow at the University of Birmingham and the University College London. He is a specialist in environmental health and risk management with several previous papers on oil and gas pollution. From the UK, Karin Vohra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Tell us about air pollution in India that motivated your work.
While I was growing up in northern India, I used to experience a few instances of severe air pollution episodes, specifically around the festival of Diwali, and these would often combine in the months of October, November with periods of agricultural residue burning. And so what would happen, there would be days where we would not see any sunlight, and me and my family members, we would often experience like a lump in our throat because there was so much of particle pollution that was just there, but we never realized that, okay, there's just so much of pollution that's existing. So there was this complex mix of air pollution, both local because of the festival, and then there was transported pollution from the agricultural residue burning. And so that really motivated me to study, okay, we know so much about air pollution, but there was nothing that was effective. And unfortunately, even now, there's nothing that's effectively tackled that problem. And so I've always been motivated to understand more about air pollution and human health and what we can do to mitigate this problem and improve public health.
In 2021, you led a study finding 1 in 5 deaths around the world was caused by burning fossil fuels. A year later, you warned of premature mortality in fast-growing cities in the tropics. Why have you now turned to pollution in the United States?
So as I was describing, so we've always been interested in understanding more about air pollution and health. And when we conducted the study looking at the fossil fuels globally, we did target fossil fuels because it was one human sector, anthropogenic sector, that from emissions from which could be easily mitigated. And then when I started looking at tropical cities, the motivation for looking at those was because a lot of these cities did not have routine air quality measurements. And when we did this assessment, we did find that most of the air quality degradation that was happening in these cities was driven by increasing human activities. So I've always been targeting sectors or emerging and novel air pollution sources that need to be targeted and emissions from which need to be mitigated. And so it was a logical next step for us to investigate the U.S., where it's the world's largest oil and gas industry. So right now what was happening, reliance on coal was declining when we started this project. And we wanted to investigate what's the impact of the entire life cycle of the oil and gas sector.
Yes, in the last few years, the U.S. produced more gas and oil than Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Canada combined. The new administration wants to make even more. What price are Americans paying for this fossil energy dominance?
Yes, so we did a comprehensive health impact assessment, investigating the health burden across various age groups, from the unborn to the elderly population. And we did estimate 91,000 early deaths that were linked to the air pollution from the oil and gas life cycle. And we also estimated hundreds and thousands of incidences of preterm births, asthma in children, as well as cancer. all linked to air pollution from the oil and gas life cycle.
Was that 91,000 early deaths, is that from a period over a decade or two decades, or is that every year? What's the time period?
Yeah,
there?
So I'll clarify that. Yes, so these are annual. So 91,000 were the annual health burden, and we estimated these for 2017.
What are the toxic byproducts that you used in your study?
Yes, so we looked at a suite of pollutants that were there. So we looked at health-harming gases that range from nitrogen dioxide, which also form ozone. Then we also looked at cancer-causing hazardous air pollutants. So we looked at three of these. It included formaldehyde, benzene, and acetaldehyde. And then we also looked at the particle pollution, or fine particles that we typically refer to as PM2.5, because all of these pollutants, both gases and particles, were linked to the oil and gas.
Oil and gas leak toxic materials at every stage of production. And what are those stages in your study?
Yeah, so we looked at four major stages, and we referred to these as upstream, which focus around exploration, extraction, and drilling of oil and gas. The second one was midstream activities, focusing on storage and transportation. And then we went to downstream activities around refinement and transformation to petrochemical products. And the final one was end use or consumption.
And what pollution from oil and gas life cycle causes the most premature deaths?
Yes. So out of the three pollutants that we were looking at, PM2.5 or fine particles, NO2 and ozone, we did see that PM2.5 was linked to the most premature deaths. The estimates were around 47,200 deaths in adults aged 25 years and above. So this is around 2% of all of the deaths in adults in that year.
Your team found more than just shortened lives. Talk to us about childhood onset asthma and cancers.
So we did estimate 216,000 incidences of asthma in children under 18 years of age, which was a very large number. And we did see that this is around 10% of the total asthma incidences in the U.S. each year in children. And in terms of cancer, we looked at lifetime incidences of cancer, around 1,600 incidences, which accounts for around 4% of cancers each year in the U.S.
And mothers are also at risk. What about preterm births?
Yes, so mothers who are pregnant and they are exposed to PM2.5, specifically from the oil and gas sector, they are at risk as well. And we did estimate around 10,300 preterm birth incidences in the U.S., which accounts for around 3% of all of the preterm births in 2017.
Karn, should we assume toxic byproducts of fossil fuel use remain localized, or can they travel large distances in the wind?
This depends more on which pollutants we're looking at. For example, nitrogen dioxide is a short-lived pollutant, and so the effect is mostly localized. But when we talk around PM2.5, which is relatively long-lived, so the impact can be both localized as well as transported. For example, in Kansas, which had far less emissions from upstream activities than Oklahoma or Texas, still had 30 PM2.5 related deaths. And this is mainly because of transported air pollution. And similarly, we were also able to push the model and include southern Canada as well as northern Mexico in our domain. And we estimated 1,200 early deaths in Canada and around 400 early deaths in northern Mexico, all linked to PM2.5 from the oil and gas life cycle.
And which two states had the most health burdens and the worst loss of life expectancy?
Across all of the health burden, we found that California and Texas have the greatest health burden. So in terms of the premature mortality, there were 17,000 premature deaths in California and around 6,000 in Texas. In terms of preterm births, around 2,000 in California and 800 in Texas. In terms of cancer risk, 300 in California and 150 in Texas. And the most severe one was related to asthma in children, around 41,000 incidences in California and 26,000 in Texas.
That's not what we picture for California. They've been working on cleaner air regulations. There does seem to be a little less smog than back in the 1970s. So what's going on there?
The thing here is, for California, we did see that the greatest health burden was in this state, which is a result of mainly high air pollution levels as well as the dense population that is there. So both of these combined together do result in the greatest health burden being in California.
And there could be many causes of lower life expectancy, say for blacks in Louisiana, maybe poorer food or less health care, for example. How did this study isolate direct causes from oil and gas versus other factors in those states?
The health risk assessment models that we use in our study, they integrate a lot of these factors, and some of these factors are easy to isolate depending on the data set that we have. But in our study, the functions that we use to estimate the health impacts do not isolate these additional factors like socioeconomic status or access to poor food, or, for example, access to health care. And so it was very difficult for us to isolate these causes from the oil and gas sector.
And everything from large-scale studies through satellite data to government statistics reveals worse health impacts for black and Asian populations. Could you tell us about that?
This is something that we knew when we started this work, that there were certain communities that were exposed to inequitable exposures as well as health burden. And what our study does is puts numbers to these to quantify just how unjust those exposures and health burdens were linked to the oil and gas life cycle. And so for that, what we did was we estimated first the national values or national rates of early deaths, incidences of asthma, cancer, and preterm birth. And then we did the same for these population subgroups by race and ethnicity and compared them to the national values. And what we find is that for upstream activities, the health burden in the Native American population is 20 to 50% greater than the national value. For downstream stage, it was the black population where the health burden for the black population is 20 to 70% greater than the national value. And when we talk of end use, the early death rate and the preterm births in the black population is 20 to 30% greater than the national value. And in terms of asthma and cancer, incidences in the Asian population, this is 30 to 50% greater than the national value. So a lot of disparate health burdens that we saw by race and ethnicity.
Well, despite illness clusters around refineries and ports that ship oil and gas, the worst pollution by far, according to your study, comes from the end-use stage. What do you mean by that, and how big is the end-use stage in the picture of oil and gas harms?
When we talk of end use, we are talking mostly around consumption. And so this consumption, most of this air pollution that is linked to the end use stage is in regions that are densely populated. And so it's not a surprise that we saw most of the health burden linked to the end use stage. For example, 90 to 96% of the early deaths were linked to the end use stage. Around 94% of the preterm births were linked to end use stage. 91% of asthma incidences in children, as well as 82% of the cancer incidences were linked to end use.
So if I got this right, to get complete data, your study used 2017 as a baseline year. The tally of U.S. premature deaths and illness is shocking then, but hasn't the industry broadly expanded since then? Is the current situation likely much worse?
Yes, you're right. So we did use data for 2017 as a baseline year, because that was the data, that was the year for which we had most of the data sets available. And the industry, like the oil and gas production, has increased between 2017 and 2023 by 40%, and consumption has increased by 8%. So it is likely that the situation is much worse, and our estimates were very conservative.
You also use figures from an Environmental Protection Agency database. Some of those numbers are industry reported, and outside studies have found much higher levels. And again, this sounds worse. Could we say, or should we say, the actual damages to Americans are higher than reported, but unknown?
We did rely on these existing studies which showed that levels of certain emissions were much higher than reported from the Environmental Protection Agency database. And so we did collaborate with the experts from University of Colorado Boulder, and we constructed our own emissions data set. So we combined different existing emissions inventories in order to get the most contemporary as well as robust emissions of air pollutants for the U.S. linked to the oil and gas life cycle for 2017.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Karin Vohra about air pollution and the deaths from the oil and gas industry. In previous times, we might expect governments would become concerned with this data in your report and try to regulate every stage to reduce pollution. The current U.S. government and other governments in other countries are tossing out not just regulations, but even requirements to monitor or report air pollution. Is it possible this paper could not be produced for 2025 or 2026 as data disappears?
Unfortunately, that may be possible because data availability was very crucial for a comprehensive assessment like ours. For example, we were constructing emissions inventory where we had to rely on these multiple emissions data sets. We were using state-of-the-art model that does rely on funding from certain governments. And we evaluated these model outputs against observations that are possible because of the funding that's out there. And so once we have these model outputs, we are able to use health data, for example, from Center for Diseases and Control. So it's very crucial to have data. And without that, I don't think such a comprehensive assessment is possible in the future.
I don't often see studies with such detail about sources and methods. You must have anticipated criticism from fossil fuel lobbies. Have the authors received any pushback on this study yet? Do you expect it?
We've been very transparent in our methods, and the idea behind this was so we provide all the necessary details for such an important study to be replicated, not just for the U.S., but also for other regions as well. And so far, we did not receive any pushback directly, but neither did we when we did the 2021 study on global fossil fuels.
How does this paper fit into the eco-justice movement, which is already being actively repressed by authorities in the United States?
As we briefly discussed earlier, so ours was the first study which investigated the racial ethnic disparities that were linked to air pollution from the oil and gas sector. So for upstream and midstream activities, we were able to see that there is inequitable exposure for the Native Americans, Hispanic, and the black population. And in the black and Asian population, drink to the downstream stages as well as the end-use stage.
How many of these deaths are preventable? Did anyone calculate a spreadsheet of costs to cut pollution versus life saved? I mean, for example, are the specific parts of this life cycle that could be cleaned up at a relatively low cost, saving a lot of lives, versus other steps that would seem impossibly expensive for just a few lives saved?
In our study, so we are not health economic experts, and so it was very difficult for us to conduct such an assessment. But yes, it would be ideal to also have a follow-on study where we do a cost-benefit analysis and are able to quantify which or identify which should be those specific parts of the life cycle. It's definitely beneficial to transition to cleaner fuel, but it needs a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis to be able to comment on this.
The maps in this study are easy to understand. People near high oil and gas production and refining are at a much higher risk of premature death or birth. If current governments and corporations refuse to do anything about pollution, is the only option to move to a place with cleaner air?
I wish that was the ideal scenario, and it was easy to move to a place where the air is clean, but unfortunately, I think it comes at such a big price, and it may not be feasible for so many people around. And so I think the suggestion I think that's out there is to increase the active travel. We can probably increase activities like walking and cycling whenever possible. It may not be always possible, but if we are able to do that, we can definitely reduce the amount of fuel that we are using. And so we are indirectly reducing the pollution that's out there, and indirectly reducing the demand that would be linked to the fuel use.
China is laying out solar farms the size of valleys. Suppose fossil fuel use falls significantly, even in the United States. There are climate benefits, obviously, but would people start to live longer with less disease simply by cleaning the air?
So when we talk on the benefits on the climate, these are typically realized only 50 or 100 years from today, and they'll most likely be for our future generations. But when we talk of cleaning the air, so we will definitely see the benefits from cleaning the air because there'll be less air pollution exposure, and it will reduce the adverse health impacts that we see. So definitely beneficial to simply clean the air.
Have you conducted a similar air pollution toll for India?
Such an assessment has been very challenging. And the first thing that we briefly discussed was around data availability. So such a data set where we are able to quantify emissions from each life cycle stage is not available for many countries. And even if it exists, then it's not publicly available. And so it's difficult to look at the air pollution toll for India. But what I'm currently looking at is investigating the impact that road transportation specifically has, because we can control road transportation in India.
And what else are you working on next?
Yeah, so we're looking at the impact of clean energy and equitable transportation solutions. So we're focusing on the US, UK, and India, and we're trying to see what is the health impact of air pollution from the present-day road transportation, and how likely or what are the kind of health benefits that we would expect to see if we adopt EV or electric vehicles in the future.
From UCL and University of Birmingham, we've been speaking with Dr. Karin Vohra. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Karin, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Ozone is a big factor in global warming. A new study led by University of Reading found ozone could be the second largest contributor to future warming by 2050. Ironically, efforts to restore the protective ozone layer may add to the climate shift. Let's investigate with lead author William J. Collins, professor of climate processes at University of Reading. He's been working and publishing on this sticky problem for 20 years. From Reading, UK, Bill Collins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What is ozone? Could we see it in a jar?
Ozone is a gas in the atmosphere that's not very, certainly down at our level, is not very prevalent. It's a few parts per billion. That may not sound very much, but it can have important consequences for health and for climate. There's a bit more of it in the stratosphere when it can reach a few parts per million. Again, parts per million doesn't sound very much, but those parts per million in the stratosphere are enough to protect us from the worst radiation from the sun.
Is ozone a greenhouse gas in itself?
Yes, it is, yes. So greenhouse gases act by trapping the heat given off in the form of infrared radiation by the Earth. And ozone is very effective at trapping that heat. So yes, it acts as a greenhouse gas, both down at the troposphere, our level, and up in the stratosphere as well.
From the human perspective, ozone has two faces. In the upper atmosphere, it helps prevent cancer by shielding ultraviolet rays from the sun. Here on the ground, ozone is part of the smog that kills millions of people a year. So there's good ozone and bad ozone?
Yes, that's the way some people like to talk about it. I mean, I guess from a chemistry point of view, we just call it ozone. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's toxic to people and to plants as well. So not only does it mean that, we shouldn't breathe it, but it can actually damage crops and reduce crop productivity. So we've taken lots of steps over the last few decades, ever since it was identified really in Los Angeles that we were producing it down at ground level. So we've taken steps, or many countries have taken steps to reduce the pollutants that produce ozone. However, quite the opposite is true in the stratosphere. I mean, we wouldn't like to be up in the stratosphere breathing it, but as long as it's away from us, it's protecting us, as you said, from the ultraviolet rays from the sun, which would be very damaging both to us and to wildlife and to vegetation as well. So too much ultraviolet light would be hugely detrimental. And saving the ozone layer has been one of the big environmental success stories of recent decades. So countries around the world signed a protocol called the Montreal Protocol back in the 1990s. And that's been probably the most successful global agreement on environmental legislation we've ever had.
Yes, we hope that upper ozone level will recover and the ozone hole over Antarctica in particular will replenish itself. But you say that could contribute to more warming. How does that work?
Yes, well, as we were discussing earlier, ozone is a greenhouse gas, and it's also a greenhouse gas even when it's up in the stratosphere, you know, 20 kilometers high. So we definitely want that ozone to recover because we would be have severe environmental consequences if it didn't recover, but we pay a bit of a penalty in terms of the climate effect because it's a greenhouse gas. This recovery will end up warming the Earth. There's a sort of a slight analogy here with ground level pollutants called aerosols. So these are particles that are very noxious to breathe in, and we don't want to. But they cool the climate. So we've taken strong action to remove particularly sulfur from fuels and so on, which has been good for health, but actually harmed increased global warming. But we've taken the viewpoint that actually direct damage to human health is more important to solve, and that we should maybe address the global warming issue.
Aerosol pollution does not actually add to the amount of warming by our emissions. I mean, smog stops the true energy imbalance from greenhouse gases from appearing. It cools us somewhat. Is that true of the upper level ozone? I mean, if ozone manages to refill that hole, is it actually adding to warming, or is it revealing heating caused by other sources?
Yes, I guess you could argue that way. Whichever way it is, the world will be warmer if the ozone hole. But I think in terms of the lesser evil, it's more important for the ozone hole to recover and for us to address the climate problem through, as I said, we don't want to make the ozone hole worse just from a climate point of view, because that would be so damaging to the environment.
So the oxygen that we breathe has two atoms in it, and the ozone has three. And it is fascinating how three oxygen molecules get joined up. Tell us about the Chapman cycle.
So what happens is high up in the atmosphere, when we get lots of ultraviolet radiation from the sun, that's strong enough to break up oxygen molecules. So oxygen, as you said, is O2. And if the sunlight can split that actually into two single oxygen atoms, so high up in the stratosphere, we have oxygen atoms, single atoms flying around. And if they hit another oxygen molecule, they can add on to it, so we go from an O2 to an O3, and that's how ozone is formed high in the stratosphere. So that's the basic formula for why we have the stratospheric ozone layer.
I did not know that ground-level ozone can also add to warming. How does that happen?
As with other greenhouse gases, ozone traps the heat that's given off by the Earth. So this is in the form of, we call it thermal infrared radiation, and that radiation is just in the wavelength that ozone and other greenhouse gases can absorb. And we often refer to it as the greenhouse effect, but I think it's more useful to call it a blanket effect. Effectively, we're just stopping the heat given off from the Earth escaping as much as it would if you wrapped a blanket around yourself.
Is the contribution of ground-level ozone to warming relatively small or significant?
I think it's reasonably significant. I mean, I'm particularly interested in ozone. It's something I've been studying for 30 years. So I guess I am going to say it's significant. And I've generally been in institutions that have been very focused on climate and carbon dioxide. And I'm always shouting at them, please remember ozone as well. It's important to include ozone in all our climate projections. So I think ozone has generally been neglected as a climate gas, when it is pretty important. Probably about the third most important greenhouse gas. So carbon dioxide is obviously by far the most dominant, and then comes methane, and then ozone is the third most important gas.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
It is strange. With all the conversations I've had with scientists, ozone very seldom comes up. Has it been included in the IPCC models?
Yes, it has, and I've been responsible for building some of those models or running some of those models. So I've made sure that certainly it's something that's addressed and assessed and calculated. But I think it still deserves more attention than it should. It's often regarded as a bit of an add-on that they're slightly unwilling to put in or put in under process because of bullying from us atmospheric chemists saying you mustn't forget ozone. But hopefully with this paper it'll become much more obvious to people that it's something that should be really treated very seriously in these climate models and given the full consideration.
So, Bill Collins, when your team adds up all the ways ozone high and low adds to warming, what is the total effect? Can we get a measurement out of that?
Well, so we report these things in a slightly obscure term called the radiative forcing, which is basically how much energy the gas is trapped. And we recalculated this value using these up-to-date models, and particularly a rather new method of calculating this radiative forcing that accounts for all the meteorological changes that happen as well. And we came up with a number that's 0.27 watts per meter squared, and that probably won't mean much to many people. But the previous number in the IPCC going out to 2050 was 0.19. So we've showed it's significantly larger than was estimated in the latest IPCC report. However, if we're comparing this to carbon dioxide, then that's now close to 2 watts per meter squared. So, you know, ozone is nothing like as important as carbon dioxide. And as we were saying about healing the ozone hole, really, yes, we should be worried that it makes reducing global warming more difficult, but carbon dioxide is by far the most important greenhouse gas. And so whatever we do, we just need to keep reducing carbon dioxide as well. The reason for the ozone forcing, part of it was because of recovery of the ozone layer, so that's a bit of a trade-off. But of course, as we were talking, the ozone pollution at ground level is both damaging and warming. So we can actually take strong steps to reduce the amount of climate warming from ozone if we reduced our ground level pollution. And not our study, but similar studies with similar models that I was indeed involved with, have shown that if we really put stringent efforts in to clean up pollution, the amount of ozone we can reduce at the surface actually outweighs the greenhouse contribution from the recovery in the stratosphere. So we can actually turn ozone into a good news story if we really focus on reducing ground level pollution.
So does that ground level ozone eventually drift up into the stratosphere, or is the formation of stratospheric ozone a completely different setup?
It's actually the other way around. So stratospheric ozone wends its way down to the troposphere because it's so there's so much more of it in the stratosphere. I said something like 2 parts per million as opposed to a few tens of parts per billion down in the troposphere. So it was thought for a long time, actually, that most of the ozone we see at ground level came from the stratosphere. I said it was only research in Los Angeles smogs in the 1950s when we realized we were actually making a lot of it ourselves. But and another question people have had in the past is, could we solve the ozone hole by pushing up our ground level ozone into the stratosphere? And the answer is unfortunately no, because it's just so much more concentrated in the stratosphere that even if we could somehow direct air from the ground level up into the stratosphere, it's not concentrated enough to help mend the ozone hole.
One of the big unknowns in models and in our future is cloud formation. More clouds cool the Earth, of course, with their shade. Does ozone influence cloud formation, and is that ozone stratospheric or ground level?
So that's actually what our study found, and it's probably the first time really anyone's looked at this in any level of detail. We found actually that both stratospheric and ground level ozone reduce the amount of clouds. So that can indeed, that would increase the amount of warming because it would let more sunlight in towards the Earth's surface. But actually, clouds themselves could also act in a bit like the greenhouse effect. So not only do they stop sunlight coming in, but they trap the heat going out. That's actually why the coldest days are usually the clearest days. A cloudy day really doesn't ever get as cold as a clear day because the clouds themselves act as a blanket. And it turns out that the highest level clouds, so, round about sort of 10 kilometers or something, have a stronger effect as a blanket, as effectively another greenhouse gas, than they do in blocking the sunlight from reaching the Earth. So you might think that clouds always cool the climate, but they can certainly, in high clouds, can warm the climate as well.
So I assume we don't have a reliable way to measure ozone levels in pre-industrial times, and if so, that would make it hard to know where we're going. How did your team deal with that problem in this new study?
So we particularly didn't look at the pre-industrial level. So that's something that past studies have focused a lot on, what's the change in ozone between the 1850s and the present day, whereas we were much more looking at the future changes in ozone, where we certainly have good measurements of present day ozone. So that was one way, or particularly that meant our study didn't need to consider that we don't really have good measurements of pre-industrial ozone.
Your study assumed the shared socioeconomic pathway SSP3-7 scenario from the IPCC that would make Earth over 3 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial by end of century, and it is the direction we're going in right now. And the scenario includes continuing high aerosol pollution. What if public pressure forces governments to really clean up the air? Would that change predictions for ozone changes and ozone-forced warming?
Oh, absolutely. It's this polluted scenario, because I wanted to see what would be the impact of increased levels of pollution. But absolutely, we hope we're not going down that trend at all. In earlier studies, have looked at the effect of cleaning up pollution, and that shows a really important effect. So, absolutely, if we take strong action to clean up pollutants, and these pollutants are particularly oxides of nitrogen and hydrocarbons, which come out of things like vehicle exhaust or power station chimneys and so on, hopefully countries will have an important effect on reducing ground level ozone. So that's an important health benefit, but will also give you the climate benefit as well.
Well, you've been publishing about ozone and warming and atmospheric chemistry since 2006. In that year, you co-authored the paper Radiative Forcing Since Pre-Industrial Times Due to Ozone Change in the Troposphere and the Lower Stratosphere. What are the major lessons learned on this subject in the last 20 years or so?
So I would say that this particular study, I said, it incorporated a lot more of the meteorological effects of ozone. So those past studies, we had to calculate the climate effect in a separate model to the one that we were calculating the ozone in, whereas in the most recent study, we used climate models with chemistry embedded. And so because we had the same model doing the climate and the chemistry, we could investigate the effect of the ozone on the clouds and on the amount of water vapor and on the different temperatures at different levels in the atmosphere as well. So doing this much more complete calculation, including all these meteorological factors, I think has given us a really good new understanding of the impact of ozone on climate.
In 2005, the UK government led a conference called Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change, and in that conference, they talked about a safety limit of around 400 parts per million or so CO2, and now here we are 20 years later, and we're past that, well past, we're up at 425 at least. Does that mean that it's getting too late to avoid dangerous climate change?
No, it doesn't, or it certainly doesn't from a physical climate point of view. We've shown, and one of the biggest, I think, advances in climate, that if we could stop the emissions of carbon dioxide, that would actually stop the warming. So we're not ever on physical. So we can take action and we can reduce, well, we can stop the further warming. So it's really a political question. So I think perhaps your question should be maybe put to a politician as whether they have the political will to stop, you know, emitting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
As we wrap up here, are there ozone mysteries still to crack? What are you working on?
So interesting do in this study. So we separated the effect of these ozone-depleting substances, chlorofluorocarbons and so on, but identify which pollutants were responsible for the changes in the ground-level ozone. As I said, these are a mixture of oxides of nitrogen and various different hydrocarbons. So a study that we are just, in fact, the reason I'm in a hotel is because I'm at a conference, and today we were discussing how we were going to assess these different hydrocarbons and run experiments to calculate what impact each individual hydrocarbon has. So that's where we're going next. And that will provide quite valuable policy information, because we say, oh, we must reduce the pollutants to produce ozone. Then a policymaker could say, well, which particular pollutants are most effective? You know, should we address first? Which ones should we target to have the best effect in reducing ground-level ozone? So we are just planning some model experiments that would address exactly that question.
From the University of Reading, we've been speaking with William J. Collins, Professor of Climate Processes. He is lead author in the paper titled Climate Forcing Due to Future Ozone Changes, an Intercomparison of Metrics and Methods. That is an open access paper. You can look at it yourself and find out quite a bit. Find links and more notes in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Bill, thank you for sharing this new science with us.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Perhaps some people hold a dark concept of climate conquest. They don't reduce greenhouse gases or clean up deadly air or get off fossil dependence. They, or we, think industrial tools ensure our survival, while other countries or races are hurt by the ongoing climate disasters. We win and they lose. It's a sick logic where everyone and every species loses to a destabilized climate. Case in point, Pakistan. Pakistan endured a string of spectacular climate-driven disasters. With over 1,300 glaciers, Pakistan has the largest volume of glacial ice outside the poles. But with smashing heat, glaciers fail, leaving outbursts of water and rock to wash away everything and everyone downstream. In addition, significant parts of the country flood at the same time during abnormal extreme rain events. That just happened. Lives and livelihoods are lost along with homes and business. There is no insurance and no aid to rebuild or replant. Some families never recover. In addition and separate from that, significant parts of the country have flooded at the same time during abnormal extreme rains. That just happened. Lives and livelihoods are lost along with homes and businesses. There is no insurance and no aid to rebuild or replant. Some families never recover. Who cares? Pakistan is a nuclear power. They just made a mutual defense pact with Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have long-range missiles, but no nuclear weapons that anybody knows about. Will Saudi Arabia fund their nuclear weapons development in Pakistan? Keep in mind always, both countries are unbearably hot a lot of the time. Both Pakistan and Saudi Arabia have recorded temperatures as high as 53 degrees C or 128.8 Fahrenheit, and that's in the shade. The last few years have been brutally hot. This year has been super hot. How does that change what people do? In 2015, the New York Times wrote, "Searing temperatures, which have been as high as 113 degrees Fahrenheit or 45 degrees C, a sense of panic and crisis persisted in Karachi, the country's financial and commercial capital, as well as the capital of Sindh province," end quote from the Times. More than 1,300 people died in that one heat wave in Karachi. In 2025, the New York Times reports, "Since 1960, Karachi's mean nighttime temperatures have risen by about 4.3 degrees Fahrenheit, that's 2.4 degrees Celsius. Daytime highs have risen by about 2.9 degrees Fahrenheit, studies show. Globally, temperatures have risen by about 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900, end quote from the Times. In 2016, we got a report directly from Karachi. This is from Radio EcoShock in June 2016. Our guest is the Dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's a professor of international relations concerning Earth and the environment. And Dr. Adil Najam was a vice chancellor at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan.
In Pakistan and Karachi's case, the perfect storm happened because this also came in the midst of the Muslim month of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting. And what that meant was that there were people who were fasting for religious reasons, who were trying to sort of push themselves harder. More than that, the infrastructure of support that is already missing in a poor country, especially for the poorest people, became even weaker. So all of these things combined to create this sort of massive wave and this number of the very large number of people who died because of it. And it literally shook not just the large city of Karachi, but the country.
And just so we know, how many people live in Karachi?
Karachi is one of the largest cities in the world. You have certainly upwards of 10 million people living in this city. And I say that without precision because Pakistan has not had a census for a very long time. And the number of people who are kind of undocumented is even larger. So my own guess is we are talking about closer to 15 rather than 10 billion people.
And is electricity for fans or air conditioning reliable in Karachi?
No, it is not. It is not reliable anywhere in Pakistan. But here is the thing. Anyone who can afford a air conditioner, which is very, very few people, and now I'm talking in single-digit percentages, can probably afford to run it because they'll also afford a generator of some sort. Anyone who can afford a fan, and that is not something that everyone would have, probably is still has some infrastructure to be able to survive and deal with this heat. The real issue is, and this is really the nub of climate change, that most people in a city like Karachi, but most people in the world, do not have the paraphernalia of dealing with these things that you and I might take for granted, right? We would take it for granted that, yes, you are poor, but that means you'll probably have a fan. Well, that's just not true for most people, not only in Karachi, but actually in the world.
And you have said half the deaths were preventable. What should national and state governments do to prepare for more heat events?
Well, I think all of the deaths are preventable. First of all, I am convinced that at least part of this, and we cannot say which part, is related to climate change. And even if this is not, we would see more and more of that. And that means there's blood on your hands and mine. Right. So first, let's just start with that this is not just nature happening on its own. This is you and I and those of us particularly who are more affluent having outsourced our misery by our lack of action on climate change.
That's so true. Well, it isn't just the heat. The 2010 floods in Pakistan were devastating. It must take years for the country to recover from such weather extremes, and I assume some farmers and families never do.
Some don't, but here is the sad thing about the flood. The 2010 floods, and we are now in 2016, never ended. What do I mean by that? We are now in the sixth consecutive year of floods. And now it doesn't even make the news. So there were multiple hundreds of people who died earlier this year in April in this year's flood. So every year since 2010, now the floods have kind of become this repetitive thing. And at least part of that is the melting of the glaciers up in the Himalayas, again, possibly with impact from climate change. And if you think about it, you know, I'm guessing your listeners are thinking, well, I didn't hear about them. That's because most people didn't hear about them. Even in Pakistani newspapers, it no longer makes news if 100 people die because of floods. And you kind of internalize this as if this is a new normal. Well, dying people should never be a normal. And it's not just the floods. We are also now in the fourth year of a drought in another part of Pakistan, in Thar, where children keep dying literally every day. And that also doesn't make news. And so this, to me, is the reality of a world with climate change. It is not simply the reality that there is more death and destruction and disaster. It is also the reality that you become immune to being moved by that death and destruction. It becomes a new normal, and we keep moving on as if, okay, this is how it was supposed to be. So if you look around the world at these climate-induced disasters, and you look at all of them together, you suddenly see, well, there's something happening. But we are also like that frog in boiling water, getting used to this as if, well, this is how it is. And that is a tragedy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Adil Najam. We're talking about Pakistan in the new age of global heat. That was from 2016. Get the full 26-minute interview with Ajit Najam at ecoshock.org. The worst for Pakistan, maybe the worst anywhere, has to be the floods of 2010, called super floods. 20 million people were displaced, as almost a third of the country went underwater. And a third of Pakistan was underwater again in 2022, another super flood. It killed at least 1,700 people and affected 33 million people. At least 700 died in the summer of 2025 as weird extreme rains turned into flash floods and landslides. Whole villages were wiped out. In between, drought lasting years has plagued other parts of the country, with agriculture endangered. Compound events are increasing, like heat waves melting glaciers, which then flood everything below. Getting back to geopolitics amid disaster, Pakistan is supposed to be a U.S. ally. It was chosen over India. Pakistan's army chief was just in the White House, and Pakistan got a better tariff deal than India. That development so affronted India, Indian Prime Minister Modi went to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. That was in China, August 31st to September 1st. Russia, North Korea, and Iran were featured guests, but dozens of countries attended. Saudi Arabia was there as a dialogue partner, not a signed-up member of the SCO. Not yet. One aim is for China to create a world economic system outside American dominance. As Al Jazeera put it, Xi, Putin, and Modi pledge unity at summit to counter U.S.-led global order. So Pakistan has a population of around 250 million people. Millions of Pakistanis live in enclaves in other countries. They are among our families and friends. We share this world in 100 ways. Their fate and response are part of a rising tide of challenge and distress in the real world, and we will all become part of that. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Thanks for listening and caring. We go out with the test. I cannot decide between two versions of a song covering hot nights, the global warming phenomenon increasing around the world. The lyrics are by Alex Smith and music by AI. First, we get the Dirty Delta Blues version, and then Suno creates an a cappella song, something it was unable to do a year ago.
Hot night.